Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
The very important information that serves Americans does not make us great. It makes us weak. It makes us ill-prepared.
The Trump administration's cuts to Arctic research could have wide-ranging impacts. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 16th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, University of Alaska Anchorage students speak out against restructuring the Native Student Services Program.
They have so many students, but they also like really know how to make connections and like find you the professors and the classes and the schedule that's really going to work for you.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. The Alaska House of Representatives passed its version of the state operating budget today after weeks of turmoil over the spending plan. The budget that passed the chamber on a caucus line 21-19 vote would provide Alaskans with a roughly $1,400 permanent fund dividend. That's in addition to a one-time funding increase for schools equivalent to a $1,000 boost per student to what's known as the base student allocation. The vote followed days of debate on dozens of amendments that sought to modify the spending plan, some of which were ultimately adopted. The most controversial was an amendment that dramatically reduced the size of the permanent fund dividend. Lawmakers on the House Finance Committee were unable to agree on reducing the dividend from the roughly $3,900 statutory figure proposed by the governor before the budget reached the floor. That's after two members of the largely Democratic House majority voted to support the large dividend in a closely divided committee. Lawmakers ultimately voted 20-17 on Friday, while three minority Republicans were out of town, to reduce the dividend to roughly $1,400. That's a figure favored by members of the largely Democratic Senate Majority Caucus and is consistent with an informal formula lawmakers have used to set the dividend in recent years. Republicans who voted against the budget say it makes promises that the state can't keep, given a grim outlook for state revenue. The budget advanced by the House today contains a large deficit that majority members say should be filled from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. That's been a non-starter for leaders in the state Senate who have said repeatedly they would prefer to cut the budget or find new revenue rather than draw from savings. Senators will examine the budget in the coming weeks. The budget is traditionally one of the last items to pass before the end of the legislative session in mid-May. Arctic research has not been spared as President Donald Trump and billionaire Elon Musk seek to slash what they see as unnecessary government spending. Margaret Williams is an Alaskan serving as a senior fellow teaching Arctic policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. She says understanding what's happening in the far north is important for people across the country and around the world.
The Arctic is changing so rapidly, and we humans need to understand what's happening, what's coming at us, and how we can plan our own lives to deal with the many impacts of a changing Arctic.
She says understanding the Arctic is important for everything from defense policy and shipping to the global food supply and weather forecasting. Already, cuts to the National Science Foundation have resulted in firings at the office that manages Arctic and Antarctic research. All but 5 staff at the nonpartisan Wilson Center have been placed on leave and are expected to be fired. That congressionally chartered nonpartisan think tank includes the Arctic and Antarctic-focused Polar Institute. More recently, major proposed cuts to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, reported by NPR and several other news organizations, could shutter additional research programs aimed at understanding the changing climate. Trump and Musk have said they see their mission as eliminating wasteful spending, but Williams says cutting scientific research on the poles is likely to hurt the U.S.'s standing as a global leader.
To cut science, to cut the very important information that serves Americans does not make us great. It makes us weak. It makes us ill-prepared. It makes us insecure and vulnerable.
Asked about the cuts to various Arctic programs last month, Republican U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski said she worries the cuts could have a lasting impact.
You've not only impacted good people that are working hard, but you may lose out on the investments that we have made in these programs over the years, and that would be a loss.
She said the cuts to polar research are especially puzzling given the president's stated interest in Greenland. Alaska organizations that provide weather and environmental information to mariners and subsistence hunters are bracing for reduced funding. The cuts have not been approved, but according to a draft budget memo, the Trump administration is considering slashing more than a quarter of the funding for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in 2026. The Alaska Ocean Observing System is one local NOAA program that provides coastal and ocean data to improve the safety of boaters, fishermen, and subsistence hunters. The executive director of the organization, Shana Wisdom, says the proposed budget would eliminate the program.
It would completely shut us down. And we have projects across Alaska. We would be pulling assets out of the water.
The organization's projects include supporting indigenous observers who track changes in their communities, mapping whaling trails, and monitoring harmful algal blooms. In another project, hunters in Point Hope, Utqiagvik, and Wainwright collaborated with scientists to install buoys at popular subsistence locations to track wave height. The buoys then provide real-time data via an app about when it's safe to hunt whales, seals, or walruses. Steve White is the executive director at Marine Exchange of Alaska. The organization partnered with the program to install weather stations on vessels so that other boaters get real-time conditions from remote areas. He says losing such initiatives would be a huge hit to a state that already lacks weather reporting.
Up in Alaska, you got to have good weather information. It could determine whether you die or whether you come back or whether you should go out on a boat or not.
If the Trump administration's proposed changes go through, Wisdom with the Alaska Ocean Observing System says it's still unclear whether the program will have an alternative path to stay operational. Well, the Matanuska-Susitna Borough adopted a resolution at its meeting this week asking state and federal agencies to provide Ukrainian refugees with a clear pathway for residency. Over 30 Ukrainian refugees living in the Mat-Su attended the meeting to thank the borough and express concerns regarding their continued residency. KTNA's Andrew Gelderman reports.
Over 900 Ukrainian refugees reside in Alaska, according to borough data, almost a third of whom live and work in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. Following President Trump's attempt to revoke humanitarian parole for many migrants from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, many refugees fear their legal status may be targeted next. Ilya Hurin was one of the first Ukrainians to come to Alaska through the Uniting for Ukraine program. He addressed the borough with the assistance of a translator. He said he loves living in the area, but wants the borough to speak out on behalf of refugees like himself, as they fear humanitarian parole could be revoked without much warning.
What we're asking for is to hear from you that we are needed here, that we are needed by you, because it is possible that in a short period of time we could be asked to leave.
Mat-Su Borough Assembly Member Stephanie Nowers says she introduced the resolution because she sees Ukrainian refugees contributing to the community and wants them to keep living and working in the area. Following public testimony from four other refugees, the resolution passed unanimously. In Talkeetna, I'm Andrew Gelderman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new exhibit showcases the history of schools on the Kenai Peninsula.
Education is important and it's valuable, and I think museums and cultural centers help to highlight that.
That's ahead. Stay with us. University of Alaska Anchorage students who use the campus's Native Student Services program say they're concerned about the departure of longtime staff ahead of a restructuring of the program. The university announced in March that the NSS program, which aims to specifically assist Alaska Native students, would be moved into the wider Student Services Department and renamed the Indigenous and Rural Student Center. Some Alaska Native students, including Mars Kashaverov, worry that the change would make the program less responsive to their needs.
All the offices on campus can serve Native students, but NSS is specifically tailored to Native students and their needs, whether they're coming from like a village or like off the road system or like urban.
Kashaverov has circulated an online petition asking to undo the change, and as of this morning it had about 2,000 signatures. As part of the restructuring, the program's assistant director was placed on administrative leave with a notice of layoff in June. She and the one other full-time staff member have since left, according to UAA. Kashaverov says the abrupt change comes at an inconvenient time when students are registering for classes. They say NSS was a great help with that.
They have so many students, but they also like really know how to make connections and like find you the professors and the classes and the schedule that's really going to work for you.
The university has defended restructuring NSS as a cost-saving measure and says that the program is still being staffed by a minimum of 2 people as well as student workers. Additionally, an academic advisor is available daily between 10 and 11 a.m. and again from 2 to 3 p.m. At a wider University of Alaska town hall held virtually on Tuesday, UAA Chancellor Sean Parnell acknowledged students' concerns over the loss of the 2 NSS staff members.
2 employees are gone with whom a number of students, many students, had a supportive relationship with. And that's hard to see that go away. But I also would just encourage you and say there remain caring and compassionate people who want to be there and supporting students and who are in that space even as we speak.
The changing of Native Student Services to the Indigenous and Rural Student Center is set to be official on July 1st. Kashaverov is holding out hope that that can still be halted with enough student pushback. However, if it goes through, they say they hope the university is more transparent with students and includes them in the transition. A little over 2 dozen people gathered on Saturday outside Ketchikan's federal building in solidarity and support for President Donald Trump and his policies, KRBD's Maria Dudzak reports.
The rally was announced on a Ketchikan community Facebook page. The message? Conservatives in Southeast were encouraged to bring their flags and gather in front of Ketchikan's federal building on Saturday to show their support for the current administration and exercise their Second Amendment rights. Carrying American flags and banners that read Trump 2020, Trump Fix America Again, and Trump Country, the small crowd held a low-key event with no speeches or chanting. Between overcast skies and heavy rain showers, the group waved their flags as vehicles passed by, some honking their horns in support. Several of those participating in the rally said they were there to show their patriotism, like Sean Carney and Christine Morrison.
I love my country, and I'm out here to support Trump and live the life that I want to live.
I mean, I would follow suit with what he said. I just love America. I love Alaska, and I just want to bring notice to it, just represent who we are and what we love.
One participant held a speaker playing patriotic songs such as God Bless America and Toby Keith's Made in America. After a little over an hour, the group marched about a half mile to the berth for cruise ship dock, turned around, and returned to the federal building. Several said they planned to head to the Lincoln Day dinner at the Sunny Point Conference Center, a fundraiser for the District 1 Republican Party, where Congressman Nick Begich was the keynote speaker. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
Attorneys delivered opening statements Tuesday in the second trial for 2 Nenana women accused of conning their elderly friend in a real estate deal more than 5 years ago. As KUAC's Patrick Gilchrist reports, a Nenana jury will decide whether Vicki Moyle and her daughter Annie Williams are guilty of felony theft and scheme to defraud.
The case centers around the home of then 74-year-old Mae Jensen and the way it changed hands. It was worth a little more than $70,000 at the time of the transaction, but the city of Nenana had notified Jensen that the property had accrued about $65,000 in uncollected property taxes. The defendants hashed out an agreement with Jensen for Williams to take ownership of the home. They would cover the back taxes and pay Jensen the difference between that expense and the home's value. But unknown to Jensen, the city could not collect the $65,000 because of a statute of limitations on property taxes. At issue in this case is whether that fact was also unknown to the defendants, or if they used the unique tax scenario to purchase the home for roughly a tenth of what it was worth. State Prosecutor Jeffrey Rowe says testimony from city officials will show the latter was true.
Annie Williams and Vicki Moyle went into the city of Nevada office and spoke to several employees there. Ms. Moyle and Ms. Williams did their own research. They looked into the issue.
But defense attorney Patrick Roach said uncertainty about the applicable laws remained at the time of the transaction, and he framed the accusations as a way for the city of Nenana to dodge blame. He says the city had failed to enforce property tax payments for decades, and Roach told the jury that Nenana Mayor Joshua Verhagen sought to rectify that when he took office in 2018, with his team repeatedly sending out statements to property owners like Jensen.
What you're going to learn is that at some point, Mayor Verhagen realizes that they can't legally collect this money. But he's not legally prohibited from accepting it. Think about that. You can't force someone to pay it, but if they come in and give you the money, you can take it.
Jensen was the first to take the witness stand after opening statements on Tuesday. When asked by attorneys, she often replied that she didn't know or couldn't remember the technicalities and timeline of the deal. But Jensen did confirm that her signatures appeared on the paperwork involved in selling the house, and she also answered questions about her relationship with the defendants, particularly Moyle, the Nenana Senior Center director.
How do you know them?
Because I went to the senior center a lot, and we were all friends.
A Fairbanks jury convicted Williams and Moyle on all counts in late 2022. But their attorneys successfully filed for the retrial, which is now taking place in Nenana, after citing character-based testimony that had broken evidentiary rules. In Fairbanks, I'm Patrick Gilchrist.
The city of Soldotna is nearing the finish line on its new fieldhouse facility, which is scheduled to open its doors this summer. As KDLL's Ashlyn O'Hara reports, city council members last week decided how much people will pay to use and rent the Soldotna fieldhouse.
The council vote came after a work session with city parks and recreation staff, who presented some of their nuts and bolts proposals for the 42,000 square foot fieldhouse. For example, how much people should pay to get into the building. Adults using the field house will pay $5 per visit. A 10-visit punch card will run you $45, and a 3-month membership costs $100. Kids, seniors, veterans, and active duty military members are eligible for discounts.
We definitely wanted to try to find a balance between affordable access and some cost recovery.
That's Parks and Recreation Director Joel Todd, who's worked on the project since the beginning. Court rentals range from $21 to $106 per hour, depending on what is being rented. There are separate hourly rates for the fieldhouse's batting cages, and renting the whole fieldhouse will run you just over $2,500. Todd says his team arrived at the cost proposals after studying similar facilities in other parts of the state.
We're not drastically lower than some of these other facilities, but we are a little lower. So that way we can grow these programs and give them a fighting chance.
Another policy adopted by the council last week describes the priority the city will give different groups wanting to use the field house. Programs and events sponsored by the city, for example, get first dibs. That's followed by large events, nonprofit organizations, and for-profit organizations and commercial groups. Todd says in some cases, that means access will be on a first-come, first-served basis.
Because we want this facility to be multi-use, that means we're not going to be able to serve every user group and every sport all the time, all year round.
The council also heard from Jocelyn O'Connor, representing the Friends of the Soldotna Fieldhouse. The nonprofit will help fundraising through grants and community partnerships.
The purpose of this, as you talk about fees, is really to make sure that the community has access to this, so that if someone shows up and they don't have that $2 or $3, we can front them, right? We've got seed money available, and we've got fundraising efforts in the works already so that this can be immediately used and everyone has access.
Mayor Paul Whitney was one of many who celebrated the facility's road to reality last week.
It's truly a quality of life issue for the entire community, not just the city of Soldotna and its residents, but our entire community, which is quite large.
For now, Todd says they're gearing up for their grand opening.
That's kind of the spiel. most exciting part, August 16th. We've been waiting 23 years for this.
Reporting in Soldotna, I'm Ashlyn O'Hara.
History and education go hand in hand. That's why the Kenai Cultural Center is highlighting the history of education on the Kenai Peninsula in a new exhibit. As KDLL's Hunter Morrison reports, the region's education system has always stood out from others.
With more than 40 schools today, separated by land, water, and culture, it's no surprise that the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District has been called the most unique in America by current Superintendent Clayton Holland. But its one-of-a-kind dynamic goes back to the school district's pre-formative days. On view at the Kenai Chamber of Commerce are more than 80 artifacts documenting the region's early education system. In it, one can find anything from a bell used in Kenai's early Russian school to a 1936 liquor license, which is how the former Kenai Territorial School was funded. Danielle Lopez-Stom is the Kenai Cultural Center coordinator.
Our early days as a museum or cultural center, a lot of our founders and early donors were local school teachers. And so we ended up with a lot of things that came from the original schools. And so we have a lot of these things in storage, and I wanted to bring them out and just highlight education in this area.
Kenai's first school was its Russian school, opened in the 1890s. Then came the Kenai Territorial School, which for a while ran simultaneously with the Russian school. During that time, Lopez-Stom says students would attend one school for Russian lessons and the other for English lessons. Lopez-Stom also made it a point to indicate that the Kenai Peninsula's early education didn't just happen in the classroom. The installment also has artifacts on early subsistence lifestyles, a hat tip to the Dena'ina people, and homesteaders. The region saw a homesteading boom in the 1950s, which Lopez-Stom says it's part of the reason the school district was formed in the first place. While she says the new exhibit's scope likely won't go beyond local recognition, Lopez-Stom says it's important to highlight it in light of recent federal actions.
Education is important and it's valuable, and I think museums and cultural centers help to highlight that. And working collaboratively with local schools and just encouraging studying the history of those local schools and how they formed, I think helps people respect them better and understand why they are valuable and important.
Although some of the museum's artifacts have been displayed in the Cultural Center's recent history exhibits, many have not seen the light of day since they were actually used in local schools. They'll be on view through the end of the month. In Kenai, I'm Hunter Morrison.
9 Wrangell Middle School wrestlers tried pinning down their opponents this spring in Fairbanks at the 49th Annual Tanana Invitational Wrestling Tournament, and one teammate returned home as a first-place state champion. KSDK's Colette Zarnicki talked with some of the wrestlers to get the scoop on how it went on and off the mat.
Eighth grader Arabella Knorr surprised herself while wrestling on the mat during the state champion tournament. She pinned her opponent in the final, even though she was losing by 1 in the third round.
Just wasn't expecting it at all. I was like, wait, did they say my name or something like that? It's really overwhelming because there's a lot of people.
Coach Jack Carney says there were about 2,000 people in the gym. With all that pressure, he says Noor did a really good job against a really strong girl.
It was a really exciting match because she was down by 1 point in the third round, and she had to choose. The girl chose top, so Arabella was on bottom, so she had to get up and out. And while she was getting up and out, she flipped the girl over and pinned her. So she won by pin in the third round, and the crowd went crazy. She was the first match of the night, so everybody was really excited to see that.
He says this was the biggest turnout at the Tanana tournament so far, with about 800 students participating from the whole state. Carney says it's tricky to place because the wrestlers are competing against everybody from the biggest to the smallest schools.
Some of the grandfathers in the crowd had wrestled in this tournament back in the 70s, right? I wrestled in it back in the late 90s. And so it's just kind of it's kind of nostalgic for everybody. That's why they don't want to move it, but it's kind of getting to the point where they've got to find a new venue.
Another Wrangell wrestler is sixth grader Jonah Hurst. He's in his first year wrestling in middle school and placed 6th in the tournament.
It was packed full of people and just screaming nonstop because people are all excited.
And then I don't even know how many people were like watching the matches like online.
He says he loves wrestling so much that he plans on continuing the sport through high school and maybe even college.
When you get out there on the mat and you know lots of people are watching you, and it just gives you confidence and adrenaline, kind of.
Another teammate is sixth grader Mariah Carney, who placed 11th. After eighth place, the tournament doesn't keep track anymore, though. But that didn't stop her from being excited about wrestling. And as the benefit of being the coach's daughter, she's been wrestling since she was just 4 years old.
I just like wrestling. And so it's mostly the same, no matter if you're in the finals or if you're just wrestling a match, your goal is to win.
Aside from wrestling, the group visited ice sculptures, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and the Museum of the North. In Wrangell, I'm Colette Zarnicky.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Alona Nyden and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Andrew Gelderman in Talkeetna, Maria Dudzak in Ketchikan, Patrick Gilchrist in Fairbanks, Ashlyn O'Hara in Soldotna, Hunter Morrison in Kenai, and Colette Zarnicky in Wrangell. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.